Hey, it's Scarp. I've been blessed to have an incredible career in journalism, politics, and media. Along the way, I've made a lot of friends and a few frenemies. So we thought, why not turn on the mics and see what happens? Welcome to Season 2 of Scarp and Friends. I'm living my best life. So I'm excited about today's show because we've got two really smart and plugged in ladies who are experts on school choice and education, K-12 education. So we're really looking forward to that discussion. But you know, one thing that has come up a lot when I'm out and about at dinner parties or just conversations with political people in Arizona is something that will be new in 2026, which is that Arizona will now have a lieutenant governor. And the best way to think about lieutenant governor is like vice president. And actually, the way this has been set up is very similar to the federal process with the vice president. So just to back up, Arizona was really one of, I think, maybe like only two states or three states that didn't have a lieutenant governor, and what that meant. And we've seen it a lot in Arizona history, Blake, where we've had governors who have not completed their term. And every reason from death, in some cases, getting a better job elsewhere, being impeached or indicted. So there's been a number of reasons why people haven't finished their term over the last 45 years. Actually, so much so that Governor Ducey was the first governor, I want to say, like, since the early 70s, who was elected to and completed two full terms as governor. So that was kind of a big deal. But this is how frequently this has happened in Arizona. So a lot of our governors were Secretary of State. So Jan Brewer, for instance, was Secretary of State. Governor Napolitano gets tapped by Barack Obama to be head of the Department of Homeland Security at the federal level. She leaves and Jan Brewer becomes governor. And what was interesting in that scenario is that they were of opposite parties. So Democrats had put all this work into winning the governorship. And then, what, 6 years into her tenure, Napolitano leaves and a conservative Republican governor becomes governor, and a lot changed. So I think the theory for J.D. Mesnard, Senator J.D. Mesnard, a good friend who put this together, sent this to the ballot last cycle, and voters decided on it. Voters said, let's create a lieutenant governor so that there's some continuity. Let's say if something were to happen to the sitting governor or they were to leave, that the same party would retain the governorship. What's interesting to me about this is that when I was chief of staff to Governor Ducey and would go to these national conferences with other staff from governor's offices, the two things, we do these sessions about like crisis communications or issues that came up in the governor's office, and the two things that I was like so glad we didn't have that they all had to deal with was a governor's mansion and a lieutenant governor, because there would be like a scandal where the chef was running a side catering business, or people would public records request what kind of bonbons the first lady wanted. And then with the lieutenant governor, there was always, frequently I should say, a situation where the lieutenant governor got crosswise with the governor. And you've seen this on both sides of the aisle. It was just recently in New York State where Governor Kathy Hochul is kind of in hot water, very unpopular. And her lieutenant governor actually came out and said, I don't want to run with her anymore. I'm not going to be on the ticket with her, because he's kind of looking at his political future and he wants to jump ship. I think it was in Idaho where the lieutenant governor actually primaried the sitting governor and was endorsed by President Trump. And so you've seen this on both sides of the aisle. So I say all that to say people are like, well, who should these candidates pick as their lieutenant governor, both Katie Hobbs and also the Republicans running? And my view is that you really have to look at loyalty, Trump ain't all, and really thinking through this as how do you do no harm? Everybody thinks there's this big political win out of this pick, and I don't really think so. I don't think anybody's even really going to know who this person is. So my bias would be pick somebody who could be governor if they had to be, but doesn't necessarily want to be governor. They would never necessarily run for governor if they weren't in this slot, because if somebody's overly ambitious and then the governor has to do something that maybe isn't that popular or a really tough decision, which often you do have to do, I think you really risk having someone in this role who's going to be looking for how they use it to position themselves.
It's tough enough having one person with political ambitions in an office, let alone two. But you're right. I mean, if somebody wants, because in theory you would want somebody to shore up a side of the party that you wouldn't have on your
right.
own. But when do they need to pick lieutenant governor? Does it need to be before the primary or after the primary?
Well, that's interesting because technically the way I think the law was set up is you, after you become the nominee, you then select this person and they appear on the ballot together. But I've heard people kind of speculating about, do you remember when Ted Cruz ran for president and the primary was still going on between him and Trump, and he picked Carly Fiorina as announced that would be his running mate, even though he wasn't actually the nominee. So people have speculated about maybe candidates doing that, that there might be some win in the primary, or like you said, that you unify the party. I kind of think it'll be a one-day story, and then everybody will be on to the next thing. So that's why I would not sacrifice kind of loyalty and doing no harm for some kind of short-term political gain. If you can accomplish both, then great. But I think that there actually is a lot of risk with this pick. I mean, thinking back to the example of Jan Brewer becoming governor. So Jan Brewer elevates to governor and then leaving the Secretary of State slot vacant. And the way the Constitution lays it out is then as governor, she got to pick who to put in that slot. And she chose Ken Bennett, who had been the former state Senate president, known commodity. And her and her team actually came out and said, we're choosing him as a governing partner. He's somebody we can trust. He's somebody who will almost act as a lieutenant governor. And then just weeks into, might have even been days into her tenure, and she announced what she was going to do on the budget, and Ken Bennett comes out and criticizes her, and then they take away his key card access to the ninth floor. So I think like that's a vivid example. We've seen the infighting between the current statewide elected Democratic elected officials. We all remember Diane Douglas, during the Ducey administration. I just think that there's a lot that could go sideways here. So like somebody who people have said, well, who fits in that category? Who's somebody like that? And, you know, this is kind of maybe a out-of-the-box idea, but somebody like who stands out to me, who if you're the Republican nominee, who could add value, actually do the job as governor, but is not an ambitious person who would necessarily ever run for governor, and that would be somewhat known, maybe somewhat unknown to people in Maricopa County, border sheriff Mark Daniels of Cochise yeah. County. You know, this is he's a rock solid conservative. He's right on the front lines of the border issue. The individual, if elected in this slot, you have to put them in charge of a state agency. I mean, he'd be great as a DPS director, Department of Public Safety, corrections. Somebody else actually who I thought of that could also be really good, and I don't know how she'll feel about me throwing her name out there, but Rachel Mitchell. I mean, She outperformed every Republican in Maricopa County. She has crossover appeal. She's a career public servant, civil servant, prosecutor, national victim rights advocate, and somebody who doesn't wake up every day thinking about what office she's going to run for. So those are the type of people who I think would be loyal to the person who picked them. They're what I would call, you know, I would say company guys or gals who will be, who I think would be loyal soldiers. And I'm sure there's other people out there, but that would be the prism if I were advising even Katie Hobbs. You know, who can you trust on the Democratic side? And it doesn't seem like there's a lot of people you can if you're her, because, you know, Republicans kind of, we have our family fights out in the open. They do a better job keeping theirs behind closed doors, but you're starting to see that change. So I think that my big takeaway here would be proceed with caution.
Yeah. No, it seems like there's more pitfalls, and I know it was in theory to be a secession plan, but I mean, you could end up with, you know, a Ken Bennett and tissue boxes being thrown at you.
No doubt. Well, you've got some experience on the ninth floor. Maybe we should tell them to pick you, Blake.
Yeah. No, I would love to give up everything I've earned over the last however many years to go be lieutenant governor. I think I could run ADOA, though.
I think you could run a lot of things. Tourism, you know.
Do some of the fun. Maybe we could rebrand lottery. The state again.
Yeah, there you go. Well, you could probably do it cheaper than they rebranded it this last time. What was it, $700,000?
$700,000. Yeah, no, there's no sweetheart deals for me out there, sadly.
All right, we'll be right back to talk about K-12 education. Do you like winning? Well, at Winged Victory Agency, so do we. Our team is experts at strategic messaging, crisis communications, running large-scale campaigns, and really just solving problems. We won every campaign we were involved in the 2024 cycle. And our clients include businesses, CEOs, elected officials, think tanks, and major organizations all over the country. From PR to messaging, media training, and managing teams around a strategy, think of us as your easy button. Go to Winged Victory Agency to learn more, or shoot me an email at scarp@wingedvictory.agency. And thanks for listening. Well, I'm excited for this discussion because it's two friends of mine and two really smart women who know a lot about the education landscape in Arizona and nationally. Katie Ratliff, Executive Director of the Common Sense Institute, a good friend of the show who's been here a few times. Katie, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me back.
Absolutely. And also joining us today, I think for her first time on Scarp and Friends, but she is a longtime friend, Jenny Clark, a national school choice advocate and founder of Love Your School. How are you, Jenny?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
And, you know, some people may not know this. We've known each other since college. We were at U of A
together. You're not supposed to tell. People are going to make it seem like it's a grand conspiracy.
Well, except that I was an annoying reporter at the time, and you were a bigwig in student government.
Fair.
And I was probably a real annoyance, but this will be an easier interview than those ones were.
Thank goodness.
Way back when. So I want to talk about, I think, you know, people are really interested in the education issue. Now, what's fascinating to me is when Katie and I were up in the governor's office, the education issue was red hot, and it was the most dominant issue in Arizona. And we may have talked about this on a recent show. I went back and looked at some polling from like 2016 that we had done. And education was the top issue among 43% of Arizonans. So almost half of Arizonans named education as their top issue. Same polling firm, poll in November of 2024, so just a few months ago, and it was at 9%. So we've seen a shift. I think we've also seen a shift in what people are actually concerned about in education. And COVID may have been part of that, where people had their kids at home. They started to see what kids were learning or not learning, starting to ask questions. And also, frankly, you know, there was a national effort to not even have school, to just shut the schools down. And it was a really a prolonged time before the union was even able to say, we want kids in person. So I think that there's a lot of things that have changed here. But, you know, Katie, you've done extensive research at the Common Sense Institute looking at kind of the current state of K-12 education in Arizona. So what have we actually seen on the ground change in terms of how people, where they're sending their kids, you know, what's happening out there?
Well, you're so right, Scarp. And what's so interesting to us is, you're right, 5, 6, 7 years ago, education was a major issue, but it was all about education funding. How do we get more money into the current system?
Mm-hmm.
What's changed now is the education issues we're talking about today are more about how do we deliver a better product? How do we change the system? How do we create brand new systems and new delivery methods that we've never had before? How do we innovate and deliver a better product for students? And that's what we're seeing in the data around where kids are actually going and where they're showing up. District school attendance has not grown since 2012. So all of the growth that we have seen in the overall K-12 system since 2012 has been in the charter sector.
Mm-hmm.
More recently, we're now seeing that growth in the ESA sector, in students that are homeschooling, micro schools, going to private schools. There are new private schools popping up all the time. But we now have a shrinking K-12 aged population. So we're really having to make some interesting choices. A lot of the policy models that we have created over the years and relied upon don't make sense anymore and aren't working anymore because we're not seeing overall growth in the number of students that are available for all of these models. And there are so many new and different ways to get an education these days.
But I guess so all of that makes sense. The question I would ask is our policymakers, and when I say policymakers, I think of everybody from the governor to the school board member and everybody in between legislature, are we adapting to this new reality of the fact that we do have a smaller school population? I mean, look at what's happening with some of these bankruptcies and things happening with schools. And, you know, are we adjusting our policy to deal with this new environment?
Not fast enough.
Mm.
ESAs were definitely an accelerant to that because they allowed new models to pop up, micro schools to take hold, all these exciting things to happen. But in terms of the underlying like school funding formula, we're not adapting it quickly enough, and you're seeing the consequences of that. We have $3 billion in unused district school space today.
Wow.
We're not offloading it. We're not doing anything with it. It's not being used to educate kids. The taxpayers have paid for it. It's just sitting there.
Yeah. Jenny, you are dealing, I mean, a big part of what you do through your organization is actually work with families who are trying to utilize these options. What are you seeing and hearing from people?
Yeah, well, I want to start, before I answer that question, with a little bit of a story. So when I think back about myself, I grew up in Arizona, went to public school, kindergarten through 12th grade, and I never realized that actually my mom open enrolled us way back in the day. We lived within walking distance from Gold Dust Elementary School, which is in the Paradise Valley Unified School District, which, by the way, doesn't exist anymore because the birth rates in that area have just plummeted.
And all the kids go to Scottsdale.
And all the kids open enrolled to Scottsdale now, that's right. But my mom open enrolled us to Desert Cove Elementary School, which she had to drive us to, and then eventually I was able to ride my bike. Feels kind of far now because I've made that drive, but apparently I was able to ride my bike back then when I turned like 10. And even back then, right, I mean, I'm 43 years old, parents were starting to really dig into these ideas of, I want something different, something better for my kid. I mean, open enrollment didn't exist probably 10 years prior to that. So we're seeing that even more now with ESA. We see, as you know, more families in the Paradise Valley Unified School District open enrolling into Scottsdale Unified than ever before. We have programs here like tuition tax credit scholarships, which are huge, existed before ESA, and we forget sometimes how many families are utilizing tax credit scholarships. And now, of course, we have the ESA program. Our ESA is still the best in the country, and I'm seeing new schools opening left and right because we have the potential for the supply to increase to whatever it needs to be to serve those families. And one of the things that I want to say that I think the districts could do better if they want to recruit families is on the students with disability front. I mean, the bottom line is that right now we have about 1 in 5 boys diagnosed with autism. We have, depending on what state you're in, nationally it's 1 in 33. Students with learning disabilities like dyslexia, 1 in 5. And we haven't seen the adjustment at the school level and the classroom level with how to teach and engage these kids. And I, one of the things I love as a mom of a student with a disability, we have 3 kids diagnosed with dyslexia. I love when national figures come out and they talk about like their background or their disability or whatever. And recently, I believe it was Alex Karp, the CEO of, oh gosh, Palantir, I think it is. I hope I'm right. And he talked about his dyslexia and how that's turned his company into what it is today and how he thinks differently. So families these days are going, I want this, or my kid has this, or we live here and we need something different. And I think that the public schools have a huge opportunity to allow partnerships to happen on their campus or to find new ways to serve these kids.
You know, I think that's so, and Katie's heard me talk about this before. I feel like the open enrollment piece is something that we don't talk about enough, that not every state or community has. You know, my sister-in-law's a former principal in the Bay Area, and she was shocked when she visited for the first time that we have school buses, because she said, we only have neighborhood schools. You can't go to another school. And it's something we take for granted, and I hear people say, well, you know, yeah, but how are kids going to get to the school? Well, I do think there's some innovative transportation solutions that could be figured out. But guess what? If a parent wants to figure it out so they can send their kid to the school of their choice, then they'll figure it out. And we should let, we're not saying you have to do this, but if people want to do this, why would we prevent that? And, you know, Katie, I know the open enrollment piece is a big part of your data that you've looked at.
Yeah, it's such a good point. And, you know, to Jenny's point, the issue with open enrollment currently is that districts can preclude students with disabilities from open enrolling. They can't preclude other students if they have capacity. But they can set what are called capacity limits for students with disabilities. And it's really sad when you go on district websites and you see that they have hundreds of seats available for students, but zero seats available for students with disabilities, especially given that we know they have all of this vacant space, excess capacity. Right. The legislature has invested tens of millions of dollars over the last several years in increasing the funding available for students with disabilities. And so it is a really important and critical option. It's still the most popular, most utilized option when we look at school choice in Arizona, but it is not available to every student today, and I think that's a real problem.
Mm-hmm. You know, the other thing that it's such a great point, the other thing that's like an intangible here is when you have this competition, charters, ESAs, open enrollment, is how it impacts the students who may stay at the neighborhood school. You know, I think of the Madison School District where I live, and they built this fabulous, massive performing arts center. And somebody associated with the school district said, isn't this amazing? I said, yes, what a testament to school choice. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, the Phoenix Arts Academy is a couple miles away. And I imagine there were a lot of families choosing that. I don't believe that that would have gotten built if there weren't other options. And now, you know, the performing arts, which was never something that schools were necessarily investing in, they're like, oh, this is something families want. There are maybe, you know, kids with special needs where that's a great tool for them. So I think that those are some intangibles that when we look at the data or have these discussions kind of get lost.
Well, what you see there with your example is specialization, right? Before, schools had to kind of do everything and do it well. You had to like dabble in the arts and right. you had to have a good football team and like don't forget about women's soccer and all those things. And it was kind of a little bit of something for everybody.
Yeah.
But now with charters, with open enrollment, with ESAs unlocking, you know, micro schools and private schools, you are able to specialize a lot more. And I think that's very reflective of Americans and what we want in this country, right? Like we're seeing the decline of like the big box everything.
Right.
And we're seeing the more like specialized, unique, like boutique type of options, even all the way down to, you know, the restaurants that we have. I remember growing up, it was like you went to like Wendy's or McDonald's on a Sunday. And now it's like you've got 10 gourmet burger shops that you can go to. So I love that, like Madison, you know, building that amazing performing arts center. And I love all of these new private schools and some of them that want to stay small and some of them want to grow. Our kids' school, we're at a brand new hybrid school, which did not exist 2 years ago. It meets 3 days a week. Right now it's in Arcadia, but we're moving to a new location because we have over 500 students in year three. Yeah, and it didn't even exist. And the founders basically said, we wanted this, which is what our school is without getting into too much detail, and it didn't exist. So we just started it. And they found perfect product market fit. And there was a bunch of other families like myself that wanted the same thing. Mm-hmm. So I think that's more the future is that specialization.
Both of you work and talk with a lot of people around the country, not just in Arizona. A lot of the things that Arizona was first on, other states are adopting. That includes the empowerment scholarships. Texas just passed this. What are some lessons learned from what we've done here that you would advise to people looking at these policies elsewhere? Are there things that we did really well and things where, okay, this is something that could be improved upon in terms of either the policy or the implementation?
I think absolutely. And it's great to be the first, but there are a lot of challenges and opportunities that come with that. And I think you've seen that definitely in Arizona. I think the thing we are doing better than any other state in the country is we're not picking winners and losers among different types of models. You saw in Texas, for example, and Utah has done this as well, they give you a different amount of money if you're going to a private school versus homeschooling. How can they know what it's really going to cost to homeschool a child and provide all of the things that a homeschooled student really needs when this is a brand new program, this is a brand new option? There are things like micro schools and hybrid schools like Jenny's kids go to that are just now starting to pop up. And so you're kind of precluding that level of innovation in your state by making that decision right out of the gate. And so we didn't pick winners and losers in Arizona. You get the same amount of money no matter where you send your kid or how you choose to educate your child. And I think that's really important. I would say, and I'd be interested in Jenny's thoughts on this too, where we have struggled and where I would advise other states to think this through is we layered a new program on top of an existing program and an existing implementation and administration of that program, which was much smaller, much more specialized, primarily at that point, special needs students. And so it's just been a challenge for the department to grow as quickly as it needed to and respond to different kinds of needs. And so I would encourage policymakers in other states to learn from that and to look at, you know, while you're passing it or prior to passing it, how are we going to implement this with fidelity? How are we going to make sure that the department or whoever is charged with implementing it has the resources that they need to do it?
Mm-hmm.
That's good. I think one of the things I'd like to encourage other states to do is kind of the go big or go home type of idea. You know, in Arizona, our program was very small for almost 10 years prior to Universal because those qualifying categories were so difficult. A lot of people forget that in Arizona, prior to our Universal ESA, where everybody qualifies, you used to have to be a public school switcher. My kids, even though we ended up home educating them because of the dyslexia, they still had to do an online charter back in the day in order to qualify for the ESA. When you had a student with a disability back in the day, you still had to to qualify for the ESA, you had to go through the public school system and get them to agree to your student having a disability. That's one of the reasons why we started Love Your School, by the way. We had so many families who had students with autism coming to us saying, I have a private diagnosis of autism from Phoenix Children's Hospital, but the public school district says the autism's not impacting their education. I can't get on an ESA. So we've given the advice to other states, hey, learn from Arizona. Make your program open and universal to everybody, because people that are moving into your state, they shouldn't have to go to public school in order to get on the ESA. Even on the income side, you know, being low income or not, our family had qualified for low income tax credit scholarships in the past. And we did have two kids on a tax credit scholarship 1 year. But then it's like, if you work hard and do well, all of a sudden you don't have access to it anymore. There's no incentive for you to work hard and make more money. So I don't like the low income caps either, the switcher caps. And then I think a lot of states have listened to us from Arizona when we've said, can you just allow private diagnoses for students with disabilities and learning disabilities? It makes no sense to make the gatekeepers for that the public school system. And I don't think they like having to do all the extra evaluations either. So those are a few things I like to encourage. Oh, and if I can, a little soapbox lately. Let's not call programs universal until they actually are. There is so much work to be done. Even after you pass a program, you got to protect it. You got to educate families. You've got to implement it. That when you say universal and then it's actually not, parents get really disappointed when they find out they don't qualify.
Jenny, like everything in our society these days, there's partisanship. Thinking back at the creation of charter schools in the 90s, that actually was a bipartisan policy in Arizona. I would say right now some of these issues seem to break down party lines. Are you seeing any signs of that changing? The teachers union has been a powerful part of the Democratic Party. I think maybe in the 90s, again, things weren't as partisan. There were some different alliances, but that's kind of where we are today. Are we seeing any shifts? Are we seeing any glimmers of hope that there might be some bipartisan consensus around some of this?
I don't think so. I think if you look at states that have passed ESA programs, they're red states. They're states that had majorities or pulled someone over to the Republican side to get their ESA bill passed. And I think for a while, those of us that were new to this whole movement and policy and everything, we thought there was what we called the blue state plan for ESAs, but it just hasn't materialized. And a big part of that is, even though the polling shows that families across the political spectrum like the idea of open enrollment, they like the idea of tax credit scholarships or ESAs, that has not trickled up, I guess you will, to elected officials and the teachers unions. But I think it's to their detriment. I will never forget, and I shared the story a couple times, someone that I knew from college who was a teacher who did not support the first attempt at universal ESA that was referred to the ballot, lovingly known as Prop 305. Mm-hmm. And then, 2022, so almost, 4 years later, he reached out to me and was like, you know what, I'm going to support ESA this time. I'm not going to sign the ballot to attempt to refer it to the ballot. And I said, well, gee, why? And he said, because I get it now. Like, I'm a teacher and I get it now. There are kids in my classroom that I want to be able to get on an ESA and go to a private school if that's what they want. So I don't think they're sharing that publicly, a lot of these teachers, but I think behind the scenes, there are more and more teachers who believe in school choice and see the benefit because they love their kids, they love their students, and they want what's best for them. We tend to hear the ones that are paid by the teachers union, or they've made it their job, right, to like be angry about school choice, like Randy Weingarten and those folks.
Right.
But I think deep down there is going to be a shift among the teachers. I don't know if there's going to be a shift among the electeds.
Yeah. And Katie, you brought up homeschooling. You know, at least when I was a kid, and I feel like there was a stigma attached to homeschooling. But you brought it up as an important part of this, micro schools as well. So what have we seen have we seen an increase in homeschooling? Does homeschooling look different today? I'm not saying there was anything wrong with it to begin with, but there was, it was not something that was talked about as kind of a mainstream educational option, and it feels like that has shifted.
It's actually the fastest growing option in Arizona. It's still small, so it was at about 2% of families. Today it's about 6% of families. So it's still overall a small part of the portfolio, but it is the fastest growing. And what's interesting about it is it doesn't look the way that it used to look. It is very innovative. It's you're pulling from a lot of different sources. To Jenny's point, programs like ESA are not just beneficial to families. They're beneficial to teachers, and they can even be beneficial to schools, traditional public schools, if they're innovative enough to do it. Under Arizona's law today, a student could be homeschooled in the morning and then decide they want to take AP Physics at the local high school in the afternoon. Parents could reach out to the high school and say, hey, what's it cost? What do you want to charge us for my daughter to come over for AP Physics? Get a price, pay using their ESA to the district school, and then say, oh, and by the way, what would it cost for her to be on the volleyball team? And pay that using their ESA so they can effectively, you know, unbundle, as it's referred to, their child's education right now if district schools, charter schools are smart enough, innovative enough, willing enough to work with parents to do that. There's nothing else that's stopping them. And so you're seeing parents just pull together these really interesting, innovative bundles of services for their students using private providers, using public schools, using all kinds of things to Jenny's point again, specialize and ensure that they're getting all of their different needs met.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, to Katie's point too, we for 1 year or a little less than a year hired a former public school teacher. She came to our house. She educated my three boys and then another family's two boys. And one of them had an autism diagnosis. And she had just had a baby. And she said, I feel like I'm having to decide whether or not to go back and teach in the public school system and put my daughter in daycare as almost a newborn or not have a job. And so we were able to pool our ESA funds and for that period of time do what worked best for our family. That was 2 years ago now. One of our kids ran track and field at a private school who said, this is the cost, and we'd love to have you on our team. So join our team, compete with us, and you can pay with your ESA. I'd like to see more public schools doing exactly that. We had a situation recently where a more rural public school actually fought against this young kiddo who's basically a baseball star, who's on an ESA, who wanted to play on the high school team. And they said, if you get rid of your ESA so that you're actually legally a traditional homeschooler, then you can play on our baseball team. But since you're on ESA and the law only protects traditional homeschoolers, you can't play baseball. And you know what that family did? Because their son is that good and he needed to have recruitment opportunities, they left the ESA program in order to be a traditional homeschooler so that the high school would accept them. So that's the kind of stuff we've got to figure out. And we have to help districts realize that, you know, you're not losing by offering these, you know, I guess paid for options, whether it's sports or classes. You're only gaining. And it's a great marketing opportunity. Like, you could be recruiting these families to become full-time students at your school by just treating them well. So I hope to see more of that, and I do hope to see more public schools realizing the incredible opportunity that they have to unbundle their education.
And maybe we should also stop attacking people who utilize these things. I am a product of 12 years of Catholic school, and I'm so sick of everybody saying how the only people at private schools are rich. I got news for you. The people at my school were, by and large, I believe it was majority Hispanic, middle class. People's parents worked bingo night to offset the tuition. So, you know, if this can be a lifeline for a family to have another option for their kids and also not go into debt doing it, mm-hmm. then I think it's great. What are some tools for people, for resources? Your organization, Jenny, helps families. tell us briefly about it and how people can get more information.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, if you're listening and you have any interest in discovering what your school or education options are, you can visit our website. It's loveyourschool.org. You can also find us on X and on Instagram as loveyourschoolaz. And we're also on Facebook. And one of the things that we love doing is talking to moms and dads and just hearing about your kids and what's going on with your kids and what are you looking for and what's missing. And you can see right when you go to our homepage, we talk about if your child is struggling, we can help. There are so many families out there whose children are struggling. And maybe this is where I'll sneak in Sold a Story, because that podcast is incredible for anyone who hasn't listened to it. We know that even in Arizona, kids are struggling to learn to read. And many parents feel like they've done something wrong. Well, you haven't done anything wrong. We would love to help you. One, if your child is struggling. Two, if you're looking for a different school. Or three, if you just want to know, you know, what ESA the ESA program is or what scholarships are out there for your kids.
Great. And Katie, a lot of not great information out there. People are looking for trusted information. Your organization is nonpartisan, doesn't do advocacy. Where can people get access to data and information that can be helpful to them?
Yeah, exactly. If you're interested in information that is just the facts, just the data, what does the data say about this program and about education in Arizona in general, you can visit our website, commonsenseinstituteaz.org, or we are also on, you're so hip and cool, Jenny, you call it X. I still call it Twitter. Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, Common Sense Institute Arizona.
Great. Well, thank you so much. I think people will find this very enlightening and really helpful. I'm living my best.